You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, so get this. This episode of the podcast will be the last one before this year's Tony Awards. The Tony Awards are this Sunday, June 10th at 8 o'clock, 7 p.m. Central. And if you haven't heard, I've got a show that's up for a big award this year. Once in This Island is up for Best Revival of a Musical. Tune in. Cross your fingers. You may very well see me on that stage. But don't forget to watch the Tonys this Sunday, June 10th, 8 o'clock, 7 p.m. Central.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Producer's Perspective podcast. I am Ken Davenport, and my guest today is the Tony Award-winning director, Rebecca Teichman.
Perfect.
I got that
well
right.
Well done.
Apparently, lots of people pronounce that name a lot of different ways, so we were debating it before we began here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Rebecca won her Tony for her thrilling direction of Indecent on Broadway. She's a prolific director of plays all over the country and all over the world. Time in the Conways for the Roundabout. You've worked at just about every nonprofit in New York City.
Almost.
Like Lincoln Center, Playwrights, Second
right,
Stage,
yes.
You name it.
And yeah.
La Jolla, Old Globe.
Yes.
You've
yes.
been everywhere.
I'm old. I've been doing this a while.
So... Well, you have been doing it a while, so when did you start directing?
Let me say it's an honor to be here and to be with you, so thank you. How the hell did this goddamn thing start? I was a terrible actress for a while. I loved it. I knew that my language, for whatever reason, I don't know that any of us can kind of articulate in a real way why, but my language seemed to just be theater, my vocabulary, how I express myself. So I got pretty lucky right after college and got kind of a large, I mean, it's all relative, but to me, a large role and an acting part. And I had to die every night and fall in love and sob. And by the end of it, I was like, that is not my path. It was so clear. So I was lucky in a way that I got that so fast. And then I started to do, I just was like trying to figure out, well, what area of theater is my home? So I did casting for a while, dramaturgy. It was like a literary intern. And eventually started directing and assistant directing and then directing my own stuff. And then I realized, first of all, it was what I was best at. And it's where I felt most alive and comfortable and excited and challenged. So once that was really clear, then I went back to grad school.
Did you have a mentor when you started assisting directing? Anyone that you looked up to that helped you come to this realization?
I was sort of doing these weird, it's a great question. I was straddling some like really opposite worlds. So this is right before going to grad school. I was assisting Gene Sachs on Barrymore that was Christopher Plummer's solo show.
Oh, yeah. So, I working for Livent at the time.
Yes, Livent. Really?
Yes.
Well, I was a child on that show. And so that was, you know, I was watching Gene and learn. I mean, basically, I was just hanging out with them and learning from them, really. And then simultaneously developing this show called Menopausal Gentlemen, like way a downtown kind of amazing queer theater piece by this company, Split Bridges, really Peggy Shaw from Split Bridges, you know, writing it and performing it. We were kind of making it together. So they were like really different parts of the spectrum of theater. And I guess, you know, like all of those people were kind of involved. It was right then that I was deciding to go to grad school that were really helpful to me thinking it through.
What was the biggest takeaway you got from grad school that impacted your career, or the biggest asset you got from it?
Well, first of all, weirdly, I mean, in a very literal way, the idea that is the seed of Indecent started as a grad student, which
really?
Is strange.
Tell us that story, Rebecca. Regale us.
It's really weird considering how long ago that was, but when I was in my first year of grad school, we had to do what was called a Drama 50 at Yale, where you direct a one-hour piece. And at that time, it was up to the directors to propose an idea of a play. And I was reading a book at that moment by Elisa Salomon called Redressing the Canon. And in it, it mentioned this play, The God of Vengeance, which is what Indecent really is about. And that it had opened on Broadway in the 20s and that there was an obscenity trial. And I was surprised I hadn't heard of it. So sort of started to do more research about it and was working with this amazing dramaturg, Rebecca Rugg. We were looked at each other and sort of thought, I wonder if we could find that obscenity trial transcript. That would just be interesting. And we called the law library and they were like, come on down. We got it. You know, and it turned out literally everything to do with that play was housed at the Yale libraries, the history of the play. So Sholomash, who wrote the play, his papers were all there. Harry Weinberger, who produced it on Broadway and then also defended it in court, his papers were there. It was just sort of wild. I sort of felt like I had dropped into this extraordinary memory. So we set about trying to make a piece out of the found materials, the transcript of the trial interwoven with the text of the play, as my Drama 50. And it was called The People Versus the God of Vengeance, which is what the trial was called. And I did that. I worked on that through my 3 years as a graduate student. So my thesis was a version. And it was very clear, I think, that the story was a very important and moving one, and that I couldn't write it, no matter how hard I tried, that just wasn't my gift. So after that, I spent a lot of time, first of all, trying to find a theater that would be kind of crazy enough to think this was a good idea and interested in commissioning a writer with me. And then once that happened, finding Paula, you know, and Paula saying yes. So it just was like, I kind of felt, I guess, that I had to caretake this memory and find a way to tell the story, because I had lived in sort of the actual papers, you know, sort of somehow different, like the handwritten everything. I felt like I knew them. And so that was a literal, you know, very concrete gift from my time there.
Let me ask you, this is twice now in your very early career where you've been very objective about your own skills and
right.
talent in a certain area, which I think is very important, because I think a lot of people
right.
bang their heads at something
mm-hmm.
that they may
mm-hmm.
not be good enough at in
right.
order to achieve the type of success that they want to achieve. What do you think gave you that objectivity to, because I'm sure you didn't have people saying, you suck at this, don't do this.
Right, we're all really good at congratulating each other.
Exactly.
Even if it's
Especially in this business.
Yes, no, totally.
Every reading I've ever been to, it's the next Pulitzer Prize winning show.
Exactamente.
So what do you think gave you that gift to see both your skills as an actor and as a writer that, not that you weren't good, but that someone might be able to
yeah,
do it
yeah,
better?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's a generous way of seeing it. I mean, I think I was enough aware as an actress that I didn't actually enjoy, once I got the thing, you know, that I actually didn't like. Like, I remember the director always said a heroine has to have good posture. And I was like, I'm just not that interested in thinking that much about my posture. I just couldn't, or vocal work, or, you know, and I basically wanted to guide the room and he was like, shut up. So it was just, that was clear. It was like kind of counterintuitive. And then it's many years later, really, that like I get my mother to admit that I was terrible, you know, but I think it was as much just for me about realizing I didn't love it. With the writing, that was humbling because it was a story I really wanted to tell. It was amazing, complex, and I know I'm a great dramaturg and a great editor. And, you know, even conceptually sort of conceiving of ideas. But with, you know, I think one of the gifts of a director is collaboration. And writers have this extraordinary ability to kind of work alone. And I just, like, kept hitting my own wall. And I knew, you know, I knew enough to read it and be like, that's just terrible writing. You know, like that doesn't come close to the complexity of the idea. So, which meant that I kept sort of, it kept being hemmed in by using the found text, which it turned out the trial on stage, sometimes a trial on stage can work, but this trial, which I thought would work, just didn't quite work. And, you know, I mean, we did it, and it wasn't like anybody was saying to me, come, let's move this to, you know, it was clearly an idea that was going to have no life unless I was able to find somebody, a partner, who could find a better way to express the story, a more powerful, meaningful way. So, I mean, it was not like, I struggled, because I really wanted, as a director, it would be great. You know, because you can just create your own material would be a really nice thing to be able to have the option to do. Not me.
So when you read other people's work now, and you do a lot of new stuff.
Yeah.
It's a two-parter, really. What makes a great play a great play? And what makes a play a play that you want to direct?
Ask you the same question.
I'm not answering.
I think for me, the main thing is, does it move me? Like, really deeply move me? You know, and I guess I hope, I want to believe that we're telling stories that move people and open them, that create empathy and, you know, that create a kind of ability to see from a different perspective in a way that's deeply moving. So that's like, it's just fundamentally, am I, you know, does it move, actually just move me? And if it does, then I usually believe I can kind of find my way through. You know, I can find a way in. And I don't know, you know, it's so subjective what makes a great play. I think there's so many different kinds of plays. So I would hesitate to sort of over-define that. But I can just say there's something about, you know, a writer who really understands rhythm and music and the kind of can get inside. And this to me is really so impressive. When somebody can truly find the voices of other people, deeply find them. And I guess I find it exciting when there's a theatrical, you know, something that makes it only a story you could tell on stage for me.
Those would have been my answers.
I could have guessed given your what you've done.
What's your process when you start working on a new play? So you say you're going to do it. Okay. Script is on your desk. What's the first thing you do? Freak out.
Yeah, right. Procrastinate. Well, I'm trying to think of really the truth. I think I do read a piece over and over and over and over again. And kind of, if there are other materials that are associated with it in any way, kind of try to immerse in the world of it and its DNA, like understand its structure or its, what's kind of making, what's it, what are its bones. And usually if it's a new play and, you know, the writer is willing, just ask them tons of questions. And then, you know, often also provocative questions that, you know, might lead to developing the piece. But it's usually, I think, sort of ideas start to come for me visually for whatever reason, I don't know. And they, but they don't come unless I really know the piece. And I think that is because I'm like a fool for story. I don't like staging a curtain call to me is like, what is going on? I have no idea. There's no story. Like, what am I doing? You know, I'm always like, who wants to stage the curtain call? But as long as when I'm tracing a story and really, you know, moved by that story and want to release that story in the most exciting, moving, theatrical way I can think of, that's a beautiful goal to me. And it starts to become, as once I really deeply understand the story, then sort of impulses start to just happen, if that makes sense.
And what about on that first day of rehearsal? What do you do when you start to get in the room with the actors?
You know, I think it's a little weird that first day because you, as a design team and the writer, you know, and the producers, you've all been sort of working on this for a big chunk of time. And then the people whose bodies are actually going to live the experience are entering it fresh. And so there's this like odd disconnect. I always feel very weird presenting a design. Like, shouldn't we have figured this out all? You know, shouldn't you guys have participated in some measure and kind of just, I don't know. It's an odd, I always find that day kind of bizarre. On that level that I know we're about to embark on this deep collaboration and yet so much has already happened. So, you know, there are some directors who I know really, and I find this fascinating, kind of really screw with that first day tradition where like they'll just assign different people different roles in what they're doing, you know, or like, I don't know, just throw it up in the air because usually that first reading can just be people are so nervous. It's sort of out of body, you know. But I find that first reading incredibly helpful. And I just usually say to the actors, if you possibly can, take the pressure completely off and wherever you are right now is the perfect place to be. And just to be honest, you know, just be present with where you wherever you're at. And I just learn a lot. I kind of need it. And then I love to just have a conversation where I hear what they're thinking. Like, what do you think about the design? What do you think about, what was it feel like to read the play? What are your questions? And kind of learn from them, hear what their instincts are, their challenges are, or, you know, what excites them. That's sort of usually that weird day one. Mm.
And in this collaborative role of a director that you wanted to be in, do you find yourself having to negotiate between actor and writer? But like, how is that process? Like specifically on Indecent, how much of an impact did the actors have on that show from first day of rehearsal till first preview in terms of some of the text?
Well, the, that was such a unique process in every way. And those, that amazing company of actors worked on the piece for years, 2 years. We did it at Yale, then we did it at La Jolla, then we did it at the Vineyard, then it moved to the court. So it was a long process. And I would say, you know, what's so useful is questions when an actor says, like, I can't quite figure this out, or this isn't making sense to me. So it's not prescriptive, but you know something's not there. And they, in terms of the creation of the physical life of that piece, that was a family that made that, you know, and I think that's why you feel their hearts in it so deeply. It was, and you can only really do that with time. We had time. Not the first pass. The first pass at Yale, when I went back and saw it again, I was like, oh my God, these scenes are terribly staged, like terrible staging. Because I just hadn't had, it was such a huge conceptual thing to understand, like, what even is it? Now, I certainly hadn't seen anything quite like it before. So just trying to get my arms kind of around the big, huge scale of, like, what is the structure? How does music relate to text? You know, what's the, how are we, it, there were some things that became really clear, really fast, like anything, any sentimental choice, just this play, spit it right out. I was like, no. but it was a real, it was a very profound, very deep collaboration, really every step of that way with everybody that worked on it. And the actors gave me ideas, you know, questioned staging impulses. They were just, I love them all so much, you know, and feel very, very close to all of them. Paula also, because she has done this and thought so much, because she is an extraordinary teacher of playwriting. She's thought a lot about being a playwright in a rehearsal room. And she just knows how to create a sense of community and family. One way she does it is she brings food. You know, like really like meals. And that just like means people hang out and eat and, you know, break bread together. And it's small, but actually huge in its way. And just her, the generosity of her spirit and the love she has of actors, like real love, I think opened everybody up.
And what do you look for from actors when they walk in the audition room for the first time?
It's interesting. I guess I might say the same thing I look for from a play, which is to be moved. You know, like I'm like, move me. Can you move me? Move me. I just want to be moved. That is really the truth. You know, I figure in a way it's like being, you do want to think a little bit like a, or yeah, like an audience member. You know, can somebody open you up and make you feel something? Laugh or, you know, really, that's the first thing. And when that happens, it's so thrilling. And then, you know, there's a question of, can we collaborate? Like, does my way of talking make sense to this person or thinking? And repetition, like, is it possible to come in and, I don't know, that's a craft that so awes me, the ability to really repeat and make something feel totally fresh and alive. You know, can somebody do that after if you've come in and kind of like, can you do it again? You know? But the first thing is just a real longing to be moved.
I want to shift gears a little bit, talk a bit about the business,
yes,
of being a director on Broadway or in the commercial or nonprofit arena.
Yeah.
We'll talk pre-Tony and we'll talk post-Tony.
Okay.
PT and PT. How much of your time did you have to think about trying to market yourself as a director and get your name out there and network and do all that stuff before the Tony? Did you really have to try to sell yourself?
I mean, yeah. You know, it shifted over the years, how and in what ways, and but it's rough. It's hard. It's a hard business to break into. I do think it's harder as a woman, as a woman director. I think that, and going back to when I began, it was harder than it is now to, you know, get people to have that, take that leap of faith on you. So it was, you know, the skills don't necessarily align, like the skill to market oneself and one's work and the ability to do the work. So it was not like that was so intuitive or easy to me, but, I did realize that I had to be creative and smart and strategic, you know, as best I could be. I mean, some of it's in the dark. You really don't know if you're making the right choice or not the right choice, or, you know, there was a long time, a lot of knocking on doors and, you know, pitching my wares. I used to walk around with a big, huge portfolio that had like pictures of my shows. And that was a great way as a young director to tell a story of just what I've done and how I think. I did that a lot.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. At the beginning, you know, I think it's hard. A lot of young directors now ask me, you know, how do you break in? It's like, how do you? I mean, how do you get, if you haven't had a kind of a somewhat large scale show where there's a budget and somebody else producing it who isn't you, how do you get that person to kind of, if they've never seen your work, to say you're the one? You know, it's like, it's a hard, that you have to kind of push that door down. Sometimes I felt like I didn't have the key to the gate and I couldn't figure out how to open the gate. And I also had to make my living. Like I didn't have the ability to kind of stay in New York and do a lot of workshops and readings and not really earn money. I had to earn my keep. So that led to, you know, a lot of trying to figure out how to do that. A lot of regional jobs, which were great. I mean, and I learned so much and was a way to make an income. But it's not been easy.
I'm going to ask you a question I've never asked anybody before.
Oh my God, I'm scared.
And I think it's a question that, you know, a lot of actors have to deal with, but something that directors probably don't talk about as much.
Right.
You have to make a living. I mean, everybody has to make a living. We have rent to pay. We have bills to pay. And you have to take jobs in order to do that.
Right.
And I think we know that actors sometimes take jobs that they may not necessarily want to take. Have you ever taken a job that you've been like, you know what? I really don't want, this isn't my ideal job right now, but I got to take it. I assume something.
I think that, okay, so one flaw, and maybe you could perceive it also as like a great quality, but is I just, as much as I needed to, I could never, ever make a choice, a big choice based on purely on money. It's just like not in my nature. So, and it was also not the values I was like taught from in my upbringing. So I think the way that I myself negotiated that was not about doing pieces that I didn't care about, but it was about a ton of travel. And at a certain point becoming so tired from traveling that I knew it wasn't a good idea emotionally, physically to keep traveling, but I needed to. So that I think is where I did kind of, and because I was scared financially not to, and really the truth is it was my agent, who's Mark Subias, who said to me when I first started working with him, you're not taking anything, anything at regional, nothing. And I was like, you know, how, what's that? And he was like, nothing. I'm not, you know, we're just going to say, no, you can't. If you ever want to not, if you need to stop traveling, you have to make space and time. And he really pushed me. It was very, very, very smart. And scary. It was like, financially, it was scary. You know, will something take that? Will something fill that vacuum? That's a while ago now, but boy, he was right. You know, strategically, he was right. I don't know if I had done it much earlier, if it would have worked. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Totally. So let's get back to this question, which you started to dive into, is just being, you're part of this group of growing now female directors, yeah, and successful ones. But talk a little bit more about your, was it obvious that there were, you weren't getting a, the right looks for possible gigs, mm-hmm, when you started out because you were a woman?
I do think, I mean, you know, you just can't deny numbers. Like, there's just facts. The facts alone tell a pretty big story that there's an inequity, and it's extreme. And, it, you know, gender-wise, and also if you look at people of directors of color, also, like, it's just, a, there's a really clear factual inequity that we all have to figure out how to, I believe, you know, shift the balance. And I do think when I was starting out that it was just, it was in just in a very like intuitive, unconscious way, it was a little harder to kind of take a leap on, especially a young woman, you know, on a young woman at that time. And I think it's true that the pool is growing, thank God. You know, it's very exciting. And, you know, when I walked off that stage at the Tony Awards and realized I was the sixth woman, it was pretty hard. I was like, wow, you know, something's wrong. And we have to, like, really work consciously and effortfully to shift that. And I, you know, and no woman of color has ever, I don't think, won that award. That's weird, you know. So, and we, because, you know, we're in this creative field, we want to believe, we think in these open-minded ways. And really, we're all creatures of habit, of course, and comfort. You know, the people we know are the people we want to work with. Makes total sense. And it's a, you know, it's a good moment where I think people are looking more consciously at those choices and being sort of challenged to think more about, you know, take a, what if you took this other path? What would that look like? Might it be really exciting if unknown?
Yeah, it's, we're not only trained to work with people that we worked with before, but also people that we're like.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It just
absolutely
makes sense.
Totally.
That, because these are the people we know, we see, we hang out with that, yep, are more like us, quote unquote, that we have to challenge ourselves to think, no, would it actually provide better art if we get someone totally different from,
yes,
ourselves for a totally different perspective?
I think that's so, I mean, it's really beautifully put and it's very true, you know, and it's a cycle that's very, very hard to break because comfort, especially if you're talking about something with a lot of money and a lot of risk, you know, you want to feel like you're in the best possible position. And sometimes that leads to like a real aversion to risk, especially with the director, like the captain of the ship. But that person, because they're guiding so many choices, you know, they're participating with the producer, making so many of the hiring choices, affects so much down the line, you know, that if you can start by like, oh yeah, get out of my comfort zone, what would happen? Might it be really, really thrilling, you know, and might it create something unexpected and new that would, you know, go beyond what we all know or what we're used to?
What do you think about the current state of playwriting in this country right now? How do you think the stuff that's coming out looks? Are we in good shape? Give it a grade.
Well, it's so different in different arenas, I think. So new plays on Broadway are struggling.
Just new writers.
New writers.
New writers that you're reading. Like, are you excited about them?
Yeah, I think that there are extraordinary writers, young voices. I mean, sometimes I feel like similarly to what I'm saying about a producer hiring a director they don't know, it's exciting for me at this point to, I've these deep collaborations with a few writers that I treasure, and there's nothing like it. And, you know, so many exciting young writers around who teach me so much, you know, and bring new ideas into my world too. It's pretty thrilling. So I just think it's the same kind of problem of opportunity and inequity there. The voices that rise, I just hope that we can be lifting up a more diverse pool of voices.
If you could get all the new, young, emerging writers in a room and could give them one piece of advice about their writing that you think is missing, what would it be? Or the biggest mistake you see that young writers or emerging writers make today? Or the one lesson?
I think just authenticity to their truth. And not feeling like you have to try to make something for somebody else. You know, that probably the greatest art is the most honest, the most vulnerable or, you know, real. And to just trust that that's enough. Not that it has to be a piece about you, but that it's not, you're not working to be clever. You know, you're working to be honest.
Okay, my last question.
Okay.
My genie question.
Yeah.
Which I want you to imagine.
Oh, no.
Genie. It's a genie. Why does everyone get scared of the genie?
I don't know, because then you're like forced to make a choice about a wish.
Yes,
and
that's
you,
exactly.
You know, you have too many wishes. You fear making one would negate another.
The genie from Aladdin comes to visit you and offers you one wish. What's the one thing that frustrates you about Broadway or about the theater in general that makes you mad? Angry, that could have you flipping up this table right now, that you'd ask this genie to wish away?
Oh, the truth right now.
Right now.
Is it my one wish would be more about our government. I mean, that's just the truth. That I'm terrified of what's happening in this country and, like, deeply afraid. And worried and shocked by it. And I would probably have to use my one wish on, you know, democracy, like, surviving what feels like a pretty big threat and not succumbing to kind of divisive, really hate-driven rhetoric that's, like, just feels... Like it keeps growing, could affect everything and everyone in this country in a way I never would have dreamed. So I think that might be that, if I was rubbing on that.
So Roseanne Barr should not audition for you.
Probably,
you're saying.
I don't think she and I would have the best connection.
a very, very good and timely answer. Thank you so much for that. Thank you, all of you out there, for listening, and we will see you next time.
Thank you, Ken.
Don't forget to watch the Tony Awards. Tune in this Sunday night, June 10th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central. Let's try to drive those ratings up, everybody. Tune in.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.